Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome along to a brand new episode of Writer's Routine. This week we're chatting to Orlando Murrin. He is one of those people who has done everything. Written for magazines, written cookbooks, run hotels, and now he's got a novel out. It's called Knife Skills for Beginners. We talk about why he's always going on tangents. Also why he plotted at the start so he'd have something to look forward to at the end. And as a chef, I bet they say write what you know. He talks about setting a murder mystery in a kitchen.
It is a death trap in there. I mean, quite apart from the knives, you've got the gas. You've got the gas playing around a pot of oil, which is the most inflammable thing that you can possibly have. You've got machines whirring that if you put your hand in, you'll take off a hand. What about a mandolin, that terrible slicing machines? They are absolutely terrible things. But I've known so many people who've taken off half a finger on a mandolin slicing potatoes for gratin dauphinois. It is a hellhole, a kitchen. And that's before you even set some professional chefs in there, because they are very, very hot-blooded, competitive, unpredictable people. So throw that lot together. A food setting is a wonderful idea.
There is more with Orlando Murrin in this week's Writer's Routine. Yes, welcome along. My name is Dan Simpson. This is Writer's Routine, where we take a look through an author's working day. We see where they work, how they work, when they work, how they do everything and sort their life out to give them the best chance of getting words down on the page. And this week's episode of Writer's Routine is brought to you by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? It's all about a murder in 1983. Unsolved, it's now regarded as one of Scotland's most gruesome unsolved murders. The killer is still on the run. A few months ago, the police announced the biggest step forward in this case for the past 40 years. And you are there as part of this live case. Ongoing, the podcast brings you everything that is happening. Across the episodes, told through a mixture of documentary and drama, it goes into the very centre of a live investigation. So you can be part of it with interviews with the senior investigating officer, forensic scientists, psychologists, as well as family members and friends of the victim. It's such a brilliant twist on true crime podcasts, an incredible way of slightly tweaking the wheel that puts you right in the heart of things, so you can try and uncover who is the cheese wire killer. If you enjoy podcasts, which I reckon you probably do, and you love storytelling, which I hope you do, and a lot of crime, a lot of our authors are crime writers, but this combines everything. You can find the series now, so you can listen to the whole lot wherever you get your shows. Search for Who is the Cheese Wire Killer and try and solve one of the most famous unsolved murders ever. This week we are chatting to Orlando Murrin, someone who has done a bit of everything. He was a semi-finalist on the TV show MasterChef back in the 90s, and his episode was viewed by 12 million people. Staggering numbers when in the scheme of things, when you think back. He then wrote cookbooks and edited food magazines and became a chef hotelier in France, and now is in Cozy Crime. It's a murder mystery all about foul play at a cookery school, which sounds about right. Write what you know and all that. It's called Knife Skills for Beginners. Paul Delamere is the detective investigating murders at a cookery school in Belgravia, one of the fanciest parts of London. We talk about how Paul very rarely does what he's supposed to do. Also, how he goes on tangents, whether research is forced by the plot or the plot comes out of research, which one is it? You can hear also why Orlando is extremely particular about his keyboard and spent a long time trying to pick the perfect one and ended up with the perfect two. We also try and figure out if magazine writing, or at least the pace of it, helps you get down a novel. There's a lot going on. It's all on the way with Orlando Murrin, and we kick things off, as we always do, with what he sees around him in the place where he sits down to write.
I've recently remodeled my writing room for the very good reason that I found that my day quite often involved a Zoom call, and I was backlit, which made it look as if I was in a cave. And I looked so gloomy and drab and kind of invisible that I switched everything round and redid the room and put in a skylight. So now I'm lit from all sides, which is, in fact, more frightening than before. But I now face a wall with two windows, one each side, so I can cast my eye out to a rainbow or a street or whatever is outside, and I have my large Mac screen in front of me, and I'm surrounded by my pictures and my piano and a large armchair for reading. But the most important thing of all is that behind me is a log burner, which I installed because, like a lot of writers, I get incredibly cold when I'm writing. Now, I've asked other writers about this, and the theories vary. Some people say it's because you don't stand up and walk around enough, which is true. I don't, because you get, you know, in the flow of it, and you don't want to break the flow, and you forget to break the flow, so you are there stationary, so you get cold even on a not particularly cold day. And I do get interrupted by my cats that bounce up and rest their heads on my hand to stop me working. So I do get little interruptions. But my theory is that the reason that writers get so cold is that you're thinking very, very hard and your blood rushes to your brain. Now, tell me if this is nonsense, but that, I think, is why I get so cold and the blood leaves my extremities and my hands are like ice blocks. With the wood burner, this is all solved because I'm in a perpetual glow of warmth and I do not get cold, thankfully, and life is so much better since I installed the wood burner.
I don't think that's a preposterous thought at all. I think you're taking a lot of energy, right? Well, I have met you for a few minutes, and after doing my research, I you know, you mentioned the piano and your pictures, and that there's a lot of art, I would say, to your life. So just talk us through some of the pictures you've got. What is there to inspire you around you?
I had when I was redoing my room, I had a cull of pictures because I'd accumulated a lot of pictures, and when someone gave me a picture or I found a picture I liked, I put it on the wall, and I've thinned them all out enormously. They're only ones that mean a lot to me. One is an enormous oil painting in the modern style of our front gate of our hotel that we had in France. You can't really tell, it's very abstract, but it's kind of an amazing piece of 19th century decaying oak, and it's very, very beautiful. And that reminds me of sunny days in France. My days in France weren't entirely sunny. I mean, the sun did shine, and the hotel restaurant that I had there was an enormous success, and let me tell you, the guests were absolutely adorable, but it was a very difficult operation. However, I survived without being murdered or murdering someone else, so that's a pleasant miracle. So that's nice to have there. Above my piano, I have an enormous, it would be like probably 1.5 meters by maybe a meter tapestry, which I sewed myself, finishing it in 1996, and it took me 4 years. And this was an age when people used to do cross stitch and tapestry, and this was a beautiful tapestry of two peacocks. And I was in maybe a difficult period of my life at the time, and my then partner was troubled, shall we say, and I sewed all my unhappiness into this tapestry. But the tapestry itself isn't unhappy, but it reminds me again perhaps of survival. I've never thought of this before. Then I have a picture of my granddad, and I have a lovely plate that was given to me by one of my best friends that was made by mentally disabled people who painted it in with wonderful colours. And I just love it. And she gave it to me. I always said I loved it. And she just gave it to me, which is a very nice thing to do. And a tiny piece of embroidery that a friend gave me that her mother, her grandmother sewed, probably in the 1930s, of a building in Exeter, which is where I live. So that's a nice coincidence that her grandmother sewed a picture. And it's beautiful, very, very fine embroidery. So those are some of the things that surround me.
Well, they've not let me down. Wide ranging. We can't all be about inspiration, though, when we're writing. So is there anything practical around you? I only ask because the new novel is crime, it's murder mystery, it's fun murder mystery as well. I mean, I'm talking plot points, a whiteboard, post-it notes, anything that just reminds you this is what you're here to do, by the way.
No, I've considered having a cork wall, and I've seen writers' walls, and I love them to bits. I love looking at them. I think they're marvellous. But I would spend my whole time moving things on that wall to the right place. I do everything on screen with a very, very few paper notes. I print out the draft maybe twice while I'm two or three times while I'm doing it, and I read it out once. But no, I don't have a wall. But what I do have is a very elaborate setup of keyboard and a special mouse. And this came from a company called the Keyboard Company in Stroud, and I went there along there and tried out all their keyboards. They have a few writers, because if you're at your keyboard the whole time, it wants to be very, very comfortable. So this is a rollerball. If anyone tries to use my computer, they cannot get near it because they can't understand what anything is. It's a kind of rolling cylindrical mouse with copy and paste keys. And my keyboard is a physical keyboard, not like a typewriter, but it has actual keys that go up and down. And I have two of them. One's a lightweight one and one's a slightly heavier weight one, but they're keys that go down. Now, I don't wish to boast, but I'm a very, very, very fast typist. I use all my fingers. And one of the heartbreaks I find in modern life is that young people are not taught to touch type. Considering how much time they're going to spend at keyboards, they're fabulous with their thumbs on little tiny things, but everyone should touch type because it saves so much time. I can go at the speed of light, I can go at the speed of shorthand with touch typing. Obviously, I'm making mistakes. So this is such an advantage because I think of something and it goes down. And when I'm interviewing someone as a journalist, I can interview and type verbatim, almost. I sound like I'm boasting. I'm not boasting. I do make mistakes, and I obviously miss off the beginnings and ends of the sentences. But that is such an advantage, and it means that you can work very fast and very comfortably. And when I'm writing the first draft, I use my light keyboard because it's a lot of keystrokes, and you can just hitting your fingers down, even though it's not particularly heavy, it's not like an old-fashioned typewriter, but even hitting them down gets quite tiring, so I appreciate a lighter keyboard. And then for my other work, I use a slightly heavier keyboard. And this all came from the Keyboard Company, who I strongly recommend to anyone. If your job is your hands and writing, then it's worth every penny that you pay to have excellent kit, I think.
I was just thinking this. I can touch type pretty well. I was never taught. It was just I grew up when I was learning this right before iPhones and screen texting became a thing. So this was just how we did it. It's not like anyone sat down and told me. It was just that's what you had to do. But you mentioned writing on the heavier keyboard for other things, maybe later into your draft. Why do that? What does a heavier keyboard bring to you and your thoughts?
It doesn't actually affect my thoughts, but I don't, because I'm not writing so much text, I don't mind it being a little bit heavier. And here comes something entirely recreational. I have discovered that when I'm writing, it's a very intense experience, or I think all writers would agree. And I didn't know this at first. I tried to do my writing and carry on with day-to-day life. But now, if I'm writing my first draft, or if my notes have come in from my trusty editor, and I need to do a rewrite, which is effectively what you're doing when you get a set of structural edits or something like that, I stop all appointments. And I, not because I can't spare an hour in the day, it would be good to have a break of an hour in the day, but I don't want the I haven't got the brain width to go out and change and do what I've got to do, or think about what I've got to do that day, or make a shopping list, or cook something. I just don't want that as well as having my brain fully occupied. So to get round finally to answering your question, in my normal life, when I'm not writing or rewriting, and at those times I switch off entirely from writing, I don't pick and fiddle away, I'm either doing the job or I'm not, I'm in between drafts, then I have a normal life, part of which involves playing the piano. I'm a very, very keen pianist. I've always been a very keen pianist. So for half an hour to a couple of hours a day, I play the piano, and I do it properly. I don't strum away to myself playing tunes that I want to hear. You know, I practice pieces and play them properly. And that involves using your hands very well. And I have found that, to my astonishment, having worked on something for maybe 1, 2, 3, 4 months, or in the case of edits, you know, 3 weeks or something, that if I'm at the keyboard, my hands are in perfectly good shape when I get back to the piano. So I have not deteriorated. So I haven't lost anything, which is absolutely brilliant. Because normally when you stop playing a musical instrument that requires such dexterity as a piano, you stop for a month and you're all rusty. Your hands aren't moving properly. My hands are moving like lightning. So the slightly heavier key helps me to keep my hands fit. Wow. Whereas when I'm writing the first draft, and you're writing, you know, thousands and thousands of words, I'm grateful to have the lighter weight, which doesn't get my hands sore and tired. Well, there's something a bit regrettable, really. And I've got a friend called Jane Corry, who also lives in Devon, and she has the same problem. So the day doesn't really start when I get up. It's a terrible nuisance, I've discovered, but I wake up in the night with brainwaves. Yeah, sure. You know, clever ideas. Very often bits of dialogue, plot points, solutions, observations. So I wake up in the night and I have my phone by my bed and I tap it into a reminder. And so I end up with, you know, 7 or 8 clever thoughts. And to be honest, they are very, very, very useful. Very, very good. So I don't sleep very well. I'm unfortunate. I normally sleep terribly well, but I don't sleep very well when I'm writing and rewriting. So I get up, deal with the cats and have my breakfast, and then not terribly, the cats wake me up at 7:30 or something like that by jumping all over me, and then I'm at work by about 8:30 or 9:00. I do, before I start on my fiction, I do deal with my correspondence, in other words, emails. So I can't just, that's one aspect of life that I can't abandon altogether, but I don't do social emails at those times, and I have a kind of car park on my computer for emails that I will answer in due course when I've got time, but I don't want to do now. But there's a lot more around authoring than I ever anticipated, around fiction writing, which requires dealing with of notes from publicity, events, people wanting things from you, magazines, dare I say, newspapers. There's a lot of flack going on the whole time. So I deal with that first thing. And then I get methodically stuck in. And having been my background is as a journalist originally, and then I became a food journalist, and then I became a chef, and then food writing. So I'm very used to sitting in front of a computer and generating what I've been asked to do. So I won't say, I mean, never say never. I've never, I don't have any kind of block. I know that I've got a job to do, which is to do that set of structural edits. I know what I'm planning to do that day, and I do it. And if it's difficult, well, I just carry on until I've solved it. Or if I can't write a first paragraph, this is the old-fashioned journalist thing, if you can't write the first paragraph, write the second and go back to the first. And very often you find you don't even need a first paragraph if you've got a good second paragraph. So problem solved. So why agonise over it? So I'm very sorry for people who find it very difficult to get onto the work and procrastinate, but I'm used to doing it, and it means that I do meet deadlines, and I deal with work as quickly as I can. So when structural edits come in, I don't. My wonderful editor at Transworld gives me a week or 2 weeks' notice when I'm to expect his edits in. So I book out that time, and so I can cancel all appointments. I can't cancel everything, but I cancel everything I can, so that I know that I'm clear to do the work. And when I'm writing the first draft, I block everything out for, you know, 3 or 4 months. Everything that I can. I mean, I'm not lunatic about it, but everything that I can. And so I just settle down and write solidly, with the occasional break for a cup of coffee and lunch, and just do it. And I find it highly immersive. I do my research as I go along. I don't, which is partly the nature of the books that I write, that my protagonist is a very dreamy-headed man who goes off on tangents the whole time. So he sees something and he does a riff about it. It's the way that his head works. He's very, very, very easily distracted. So when in the text I come across a point where he wants to have one of his riffs, that's when I go off and research that particular item. So the research is interwoven, which is really nice. So I don't have a research period of, you know, 3 weeks of research before I start writing or anything like that.
Did that come naturally, as in your lead going off on wild tangents, or was that, excuse me, did that suit just the way that you worked? You found that you worked best researching ad hoc as and when, that it was just, it made sense for him to tell us this story in quite a dreamlike way, just to give you moments to go and, oh, I'll look up at that, I'll look into this.
It's entirely natural. It just happened. I have things in common with him, as you have. I have things in common with all my characters, but I'm not quite like that. I have very wide interests, and I'm a curious person, but I'm not as easily distracted as him. It just happened that way. He has a lot of characteristics which just happened. He was born into my imagination in that way, and it developed that at first he was just kind of, he was one of those people who can't really concentrate very well, which gives me actual problems with him in the story, because I have problems with him getting him to do what I want to do, which sounds like a bit stupid. I know that he's not a real person or anything, but he won't quite do what my editor and I want him to do often, and we have to work very hard to kind of bring him round to it. I can explain that more fully in a moment. But I found that he was taking an interest in things, a lot of things that were around him, which began to be part of his skill in detection. So I realised that the reason he was going to be a very good detective and solve this terrible thing that happened to him was because he's very observant and has a lot of interests and a very, very good memory. So he can't concentrate. He can't do anything that he's asked to do. He's kind of a bit crazy in a way with the fairies, but he's got a very, very good mind, and he knows about a lot of things. And that, of course, is very, very useful for someone who's being a detective. So he's got a big resource of slightly peculiar information, not in all areas, but in a lot of them. And I discovered in the second book, which I've now written, he knows about birds and bird watching. Where did that come from? I don't know about birds and bird watching.
Let's just put you back in the day. So you're writing, it's pretty full on, as you said, very immersive. How do you know it's time to close the laptop, switch off the Big Mac screen for the day?
I get tired by about 4 or 5 o'clock. By that time, I've had enough. And I just stop. I very, very rarely work in the evenings after dinner. I thought at first, I like a glass of wine at dinner. I thought at first that I couldn't write with a glass of wine. It would come out strangely. But Before Christmas, I was commissioned by a newspaper to write a piece about stuffing the Christmas turkey. And they wanted it, they asked me to do it at 5 o'clock, and it was needed the first thing the following morning by 9 o'clock. So I realised I had to do it that evening. And I'd already had a glass of wine, actually. So I found that I could write perfectly well.
Changed a worldview.
If anything, it flowed very freely indeed in the evening. And I wrote a wonderful, funny piece about... It always comes out funny. I can't write anything seriously. Funny about stuffing turkeys, which was... And I did recommend people to stuff turkeys, I'm glad to say, because there was a... It was in response to a newspaper report that it was bad food hygiene to stuff a turkey. If you know what you're doing, you can stuff a turkey.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Thank you.
Not that I ever have, and probably ever will.
Never say never.
Well, yeah, we might get there. Terrible chef. What makes a good day for you when you... are tired and you've switched off the screen, have your glass of wine over dinner? What can you sit there and just sigh thinking, I've got that many words then, I've reached this point in the story? What is it for you, Orlando?
I don't count words. I jot down words, but only to make sure that the proportions of the story are correct, and that they say there's a murder in it. I'm not giving anything away, but say there was to be a murder in it, you'd want it to be in the right point in the book. So that's the reason that I count words. And also one's aiming for a roughly, in my case, 80 to 100,000 word books. So therefore, and I divide it, the action into five acts. So that's the reason that I count the words. But I don't have a daily word count. I know from experience that I write between 1,000, well, maybe 800, 1,000, and maybe 2,500, 3,000 words on a, I say a good day. It's not necessarily a good day, because they might not be that great, those words. But what I would consider a good day is if I've had a really good scene, if I've had my characters doing something really, having a really good exchange, and if something wonderful, some chemistry happens between them, and something happens that I wasn't expecting, which... is a great joy to a storyteller to find that, you know, there's suddenly there's something happening that you didn't know was going to happen. I mean, an example is that in Knife Skills for Beginners, and this isn't a spoiler alert, to my astonishment, about 7/8 of the way through the book, a food mixer exploded. It actually exploded in the classroom. Bam! Now, I couldn't do much. I could, of course, said that food mixer is not going to explode, but it did in my imagination explode with the full aftermath of what happened. And I thought, well, okay, that's exciting. And so had to integrate it in the story, so it made sense in the story. And it was woven into the story, and it became... You know, I'm not going to say it doesn't contain a clue, etc., etc. But again, not wishing to spoil the story, it turns out it was a genuine accident. It was incorrect thermal coupling loading. And it just happened. And I mean, in life, things do happen. And there's another scene where a couple of characters start talking, and one of them gets incredibly nosy about the other person and wants to know more and more. And I got very involved. I thought, oh my God, this is so funny, because one of them was needling the other. They were two women. I love women talking together. And she was going at it and said, oh, tell me about that. Oh, you were stalking him, were you? And so she's having a really go at the other woman, who's kind of crimson with embarrassment, kind of shrinking away, trying to say, no, you've got it all wrong. And kind of saying, no, I only saw him 6 times, etc. And Paul, who wants this conversation to continue, but obviously... goes and fiddles with, finds a curtain knob to adjust or something, so that he can carry on eavesdropping. So I love it when something happens that you're not expecting.
Well, and those tangents, at what point did you realise that was happening? Did you just find yourself touch typing and suddenly there's a food mixer exploding? Maybe a page or two before you're thinking, ah, that's a good idea, maybe I'll do that.
No, I think it's visual, actually. I'm not saying that I think visually or that I hear people talking, but I do see them in the setting. So the setting is enormously important to me. I mean, characters and setting are for me what comes first, and if there's a death, the death. Those are the things to me that come first, and then how it all happened, I have to work out later. So if I've got characters, I just love the way that they interact, and my characters, they're not all funny, but they're all unusual. But something I discovered was that my book is set in a cookery school, and I've been to many cookery schools, both teaching and kind of attending or on looking. And I've discovered that perfectly normal people who are I'm talking about amateurs here, not people learning to cook professionally, that people who arrive perfectly normal on the first morning, by lunchtime, they're pretty odd. It kind of brings out whatever they are, it makes them more of that. So if they're eager, they're like super eager. If they're very, very quiet and determined, they're more of that. If they're competitive, boy, are they competitive. So I found that with my characters that they blossomed and expanded and became more of what they were very quickly. And of course, I love that because I'm laughing at what's happening myself. So you can tell that I find the humour very, very important. And another thing that I found, which my editor helped me to explore, was that it's lovely to not just to have these characters doing their thing, but to somehow organise for them through the book to get somewhere in their lives, if you can, and help them to be feel better or be happier at the end of the book than they were at the beginning. You can't do that with all of them. One of them remains pretty odious, but...
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One of Scotland's most notorious unsolved murders.
I was the first scientist to open up these items that had been stored by the police since the time of the crime.
And it's always been in my mind for over 40 years that I could have found the guy responsible.
I firmly believe that somebody out there knows something.
Who is the Cheesewire Killer? Listen to the full series now, wherever you get your podcasts.
And this episode of Writer's Routine is brought to you by that new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheesewire Killer? Have a listen wherever you get your shows. And you could sponsor next week of the podcast if you'd like. If you've written something, it's not got the plugging and the talk and the push that you think it deserves, well, let me talk about it for you. To get involved and make that happen, support the show over at patreon.com/writersroutine. You could also get merch. There is bonus content. There is book reviews on there. There's a lot going on, and it doesn't require a lot. Just a couple of dollars a month really helps us carry on. It helps me keep bringing you these chats as often as I can with some of the best, most varied authors around, completely different voices, a new episode more or less every week. And you can help make that happen. Help it carry on by getting to patreon.com/writersroutine and pledging to support us over there. Let's get back to it with Orlando Murren then, chatting through his new novel, Cozy Crime, It's Knife Skills for Beginners. In this half, we discuss whether magazine writing helps with the pace of novel writing, also why he plotted at the start to have something to look forward to at the end. And we've already mentioned that Orlando is busy. He is a doer. We've heard about the piano and his chefing and hotel running and magazine writing. We pick up the chat talking about all of those interests and where does the drive to actually succeed at them come from, does he think?
Well, that's a very interesting question, which I've never been asked before. I suppose I'm a methodical person, and I like to plan, and I like to have an objective and to meet it. Sounds a bit kind of boring male, doesn't it? But I don't like to waste time. In terms of the book, the genesis of that was that I was actually quite guilty of procrastination with that, which was unlike me. Well, let's just say I found other things to do all those times, like all those other things that I was doing. But 3 years ago, I said to myself, I'd always planned to write a book. 20 years ago, I did a course at Arvon on beginning to write fiction or something, which was absolutely wonderful. And I'd always thought that I would, and I've always loved reading crime novels. And I said to myself, well, if you can't go on saying indefinitely that you're going to do this at some point, and I actually said to myself, right, this is now what I'm going to do next. And I remember saying the three words, I am in deadly earnest. I said those words to myself, and I said, whatever it takes, I'm going to do that next. Now, that is my project. So I got stuck in, and it wasn't particularly easy. Although I had 6 cookery books published, and I had an agent, to my astonishment, when I wrote the first half of my book, I took it to my agent, and she said, "Oh, sorry, darling, I've got another cookery author who's doing a range of some whodunits. Can't do it. Clash of interests." So I was incandescent with rage, sorrow, upset, or whatever. So I said to her, "Do you mean I've got to go on the slush pile?" She said, "Well, I wouldn't put it like that," she said. And I said, "Well, have you got a fiction agent you can suggest me to?" She said, "Well, not really, no." So I did. I had to finish the book and then go on submission on people's slush piles and send it off. And for 50 days and nights, I waited in the wilderness with no responses. This famous thing that you send it off with these charming letters to these agents who you feel that you know because you do your research and you know that they like dogs and that they like people who collect things and their favourite holiday resort and so on. So you weave all this in and that you love all their recent books that they've edited and that they've agented and everything. You do all this work and then nothing comes back. It's kind of heartbreaking. And after 50 days and nights, 2 agents did get back to me within 2 days. And so we have a happy ending on our hands. But it was terrible, that period, because I'd written something very, very with all my heart. And while I was writing it, because I'd never written fiction before, apart from the odd short story, I had the good fortune to find a retired fiction editor from a magazine fiction editor. Who helped me groom my manuscript for submission and took the rough edges off and helped me to get it ready so that it was suitable for an agent to read and wasn't quite as raw. So that was a stroke of luck, finding someone. Of course, because she was ex-magazines, we spoke the same language and we had a few of old editors that we could laugh about in common.
Let's talk about the writing for magazines and how that influenced novel writing. How did it influence novel writing? What did you learn about time scales, about being busy, about getting the words down that helped you shape your story?
They're completely different things. Even a magazine article of 1,500 words, and nowadays they're more likely to be 300 to 500 words. They used to be 2,500 words or longer. Even that is a very short piece of work. So you you plan it if you want to. If you're very accomplished and you've had lots of practice, you don't need to plan at all. You just do your interview or find out or walk around a garden, whatever you're writing, walk around the house, whatever you're writing about. And then you just sit down and write and it formulates itself as you write. So you don't have to sit and do a plan when you've written hundreds and hundreds of articles. But it's a short burst of work. A thousand words an hour is probably what most journalists reckon they can knock out. I don't mean to put it down at all, but it's a simple process. You write it. You've found your voice by having written, many articles. Then you read it through and correct it. You sometimes get someone else to read it. So I get my partner, my husband, to read it usually. So I've had no problem with that. I've had lots of practice with that. About 3 or 4 years ago, Waitrose Weekend, which is their newspaper, the supermarket newspaper, asked me to do a monthly column of 500 words, an opinion piece or something that I've felt about that week. It could be gadgets, or it could be something in the news, or it could be something I'd been cooking, or it could be Valentine's Day. It could be anything I wanted. And I found that a new challenge. It took me much longer to do than knock out the old magazine articles, because it's all in your head and it's got has to be very elegantly written. A column is a column. People expect it to have a beginning and an end, and to dance them, as it were, across the dance floor with a few twirls and things as we go. And from that, I discovered how much I loved writing humour. So I'm forever grateful to those wonderful people for commissioning me to do a column. But then, to answer finally your question, when it came to writing fiction, it's a much, much, much longer haul, and it requires much more patience and persistence and stamina and memory, because you've got so much happening, you've got and so many notes everywhere. It's a colossal operation, and of course the kind of tragic thing for people starting out is that you're doing it on spec. So you're writing something, your first draft might take you 6 months. 6 months of work on spec, and the rest, and then all the editing, and then all the letters to the agents, and then all the waiting. All that on the off chance that someone might pick you off the slush pile. I mean, that's terrible to think of how much effort that is, just for the hope of someone picking you off the slush pile.
So you've decided, I'm going to write a book. I'm finally going to get it done. What happens next in, well, now you need a plot, now you need character, location, setting, you need an idea. It seems to have come the other way around than it might do for many other authors who have an idea and decide, I'll write that. For you, I want to write a book. How did you decide what it would be about? What was that very first idea?
I wanted to write a murder mystery. So I knew that I wanted to write a murder mystery, and I knew that it would be around food. And I had a very good idea early on that it would be in a cookery school, because it's just such a great setting. I mean, kitchens are amazing places for murder mysteries. I'm surprised that not every murder mystery is set in them, because it is a death trap in there. I mean, quite apart from the knives, you've got the gas. You've got the gas playing around a pot of oil, which is the most inflammable thing that you can possibly have. You've got machines whirring that if you put your hand in, you'll take off a hand. And what about a mandolin, that terrible slicing machines? They are absolutely terrible things. But I've known so many people who've taken off half a finger on a mandolin slicing potatoes for gratin dauphinois. It is a hellhole, a kitchen. And that's before you even set some professional chefs in there, because they are very, very hot-blooded, competitive, unpredictable people. So throw that lot together. A food setting is a wonderful idea. So I added into that something else that I'm interested in, which is the characters. So I've got the 8 crazy students at the cook school, but I love big, rich, shabby houses and people, perhaps. I find them very fascinating, where they've got a lot of history. So I set it in a great big mansion in Belgravia, but it's not particularly well kept. It's just a bit faded. And I won't give anything away, but the woman who runs it, she's not ancient at all. She's only in her early 40s, but she's fairly weird. And the whole setup is odd. And the decoration is kind of a bit groaning. It's kind of high ceilings and kind of glacial drawing room that smells like a doctor's surgery, and a dining room painted that terrible kind of dark red shade, which I think is called puce, which is bilious, which makes me feel sick thinking of it. And she's got all the kind of, in this house, she's kept, because it's her family house, she's kept the old servant spells and things. So it's very atmospheric. And the scullery is down a set of cranky old stairs because, you know, don't care if the servants break their necks. But the main staircase is rather grand and goes up right up to the attic. So the setting and the characters and the setup came to me, and then it was a case of making a story out of it. I'm a beginner. This is my first novel. So I planned it very, very carefully indeed. And two reasons for that. You need a watertight, plausible plot. So I needed to have someone, a big reveal at the end, and I needed to make sure that that was covered up. And I needed to have confidence that I was heading somewhere and it wasn't just a kind of pile of writing. And the other thing, which is again to do with confidence, that I needed a big scene at the end that I was looking forward to writing. I wanted a big ending, like, you know, the last act, the last scene, with everyone on stage with wonderful things happening. And looking forward to writing that kept me through the harder bits of the writing, because there are hard bits, and there are bits where you lose faith and you think, oh dear, is this a story any good at all? And I was able to say to myself, well, maybe it's something a bit here, but remember what we've got coming up at the end. Remember that reveal that you've got worked out for them, and remember that scene at the end, what fun that is going to be to write.
Like looking forward to dessert, really.
Exactly, you've got it. That's it. So I reward myself with something which I'm just dying to write at the end. And so I plan it very, very carefully indeed. And at one point, I realised that I was planning it so carefully that the time had come to actually write the thing, to stop doing the outline, which had expanded to something like 30,000 words, but actually write it. And so I planned it. But as I said, these odd things happened along the way, and they're lovely surprises. But otherwise, I knew what was happening along the way. Very.
What have you learned from writing this novel? And as you said, you've got the second one done now as well. What have you learned about how you work best, where you work best, what needs to be done that will help you going forward?
Well, I've learned a lot about, in every way, I've learned a lot about human nature by thinking more about why people do things and how people do things, and maybe giving people a bit more allowance for their behaviour, because you're forced, and I didn't realise this before I started, if you're writing a story that is meant to be realistic, and the whole point of a murder mystery is that people believe in their imaginations that it is happening, everything has to be very, very plausible. You can't have someone walking into a room without a reason. People don't. Occasionally, surprises do happen. But otherwise, people are driven by the need to do something, go somewhere, say something. And you can't just manipulate them around like cardboard characters. And, you know, people arriving at the right moment. And my trusty editor, Finn, he has this phrase where he says, it's a little too convenient that such and such happens. And what he means is, I've caused something to happen in the story, someone to say something or to reveal something about themselves that is not plausibly triggered by the story. And we've talked about why this happens in my writing. And he finds it quite commonly with writers that they... If you are if you plot very carefully and you work your outline out very carefully, it can happen that the character's motivation is left a bit thin because you've got them like a chessboard moving around this chessboard and you're not properly working out from their point of view why they're doing this stuff. So he says that that can be a common problem with people who outline very carefully, that the character's motivation to do what they're doing is not properly explained. So I have to go back very carefully and go back over it. And the problem I mentioned earlier, that one of the problems I have with my hero is that he won't concentrate. He won't concentrate on the job in hand. He's, first of all, he's very easily distracted, but he doesn't react properly to clues. And when he doesn't explain enough how he's working things out as he goes along. So we have to keep him, my editor and I, very concentrate, Paul. You're in big trouble here. You're in very, very, very serious trouble. You're either going to, you know, your life is in danger here. So don't go off on a tangent here. Think about what's happening. Watch what people are doing and tell us what you're observing. Share it with us.
And where does that leave you with plotting future novels? But you plotted this one very thoroughly and then became aware that maybe that wasn't wholly the wisest thing to do in terms of character motivation, as you said. Sometimes your leads want to go off and do their own thing. How do you strike that balance going forward?
Well, I would like to... I would like to plot more loosely. And I know people who do plot very loosely or not at all. The famous person is Lisa Jewell, who writes simply staggeringly wonderful books. And I said to her, when she said that she doesn't outline, she doesn't do an outline at all, she just kind of starts writing, I said that it gives them a kind of urgent unpredictability. And she said, yes, she said that it's been called random energy, because it, she doesn't have the problem that I have, because she's only got characters reacting and colliding, and she's the characters are alive in the story to her, and she doesn't know what they're going to do and where they're going to happen. I don't know whether it's possible to combine the two approaches, but given that I need, from a confidence point of view, to know that I'm aiming for a big reveal that I trust is going to be thrilling and a big last scene that I trust people are going to just adore, then maybe I can plan the ending and then leave more in the middle to happen by itself. But I don't know. I mean, it has worked for the first and second books. I've got books that I'm really, really happy about. The fact that I have to torture myself along the way. But I'd have to torture myself along the way if I did it without an outline, wouldn't I? I'd just be torturing myself in different ways and torturing my editor as well, wouldn't I? There would be different sets of problems, I suspect.
What's the next interest? What's the next fascination that's going to take you over? Maybe away from novels?
I said to someone who said to me, you've had a lot of careers, which I have had lots of different jobs in my life, and I've enjoyed them all. I do feel that this one is where I might have been aiming all along, because it seems to bring everything together. It brings all my interests together, including my random bits of knowledge and things that I like. I love people, so the characters. I love houses and settings, so yeah. So it's a kind of synthesis of everything that I like, and I love humour, and I love surprising people. So I kind of think this is my last job. And I hope that I've got many more books in me. I would love to write a really dark psychological suspense book, but I'm not planning one, because I'm very happy writing what I'm writing at the moment, which is cozy crime. So it's cozy culinary crime, and I'm very happy indeed in that slot, as it were.
Yeah, hard to write a lot of humour with a dark, foreboding psychological thriller.
I would have thought so. Because I think it could be the enemy. Having a chuckle is probably not going to get the creeps running down your spine. I had to sum up my current book in three words, what it did in three words, and I was very pleased with myself. I said, I would like that it makes you smile, salivate and shiver. Do you like that?
It's a nice blend, isn't it? is it for Orlando Murrin on the show. Thank you so much to Orlando for coming on. That new book is Knife Skills for Beginners. It is out right now. Next week, we'll have a brand new author on the podcast. In the meantime, you can support us, patreon.com/writersroutine. We are sponsored by the new true crime podcast, Who is the Cheese Wire Killer? You can have a listen, search for that wherever you get your shows. And you can get in touch with us using the contact page at writersroutine.com and drop us a follow on X. We are there too, at writerspod. And I will see you next week. Until then, bye-bye.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.